From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, rogue general's forces attacks the Libyan parliament. Latest on the Ukraine crisis, campaign aims for this week's election in Malawi, plus is there a fight to be forgotten? Militiamen loyal to a retired Libyan general say they have suspended parliament after launching an attack against the legislative body. Edward Iranian is following the story.
Two militia units loyal to a retired general stormed Libya's parliament building, ransacking lawmakers' offices and firing automatic weapons into the air. Shelling could also be heard in the vicinity of the building as clouds of black smoke poured into the air. Libyan state TV reported the armed units kidnapped Speaker Nuri Boussahmane and seven other lawmakers. Al Jazeera TV and the local Libyan Al-Mada network reported that Boussahmane denied he had been kidnapped.
إنما يحدث في بنغازي الآن من بعض ضباط ومنتسبي الجيش.
Earlier, at a news conference, Boussahmane had called the attack by men loyal to former Army Chief of Staff Khalifa Haftar a coup against Libya's legitimate government and called on opposing militias belonging to mostly Islamist groups to counter the attacks. He said General Haftar and his supporters should be arrested. General Haftar's supporters told Al Arabiya TV the attack on the parliament building was intended to block the appointment of a new government under businessman Ahmed Maitik. Maitik's appointment as prime minister 2 weeks ago was disputed by top lawmakers who claimed his confirmation vote took place without a quorum. Maitik is supported by Islamist lawmakers and militias. A pro-Western prime minister, Ali Zaidan, was removed from office in a disputed vote of no confidence early last month.
إن ملحمة الكرامة التي انطلقت اليوم من مهد الثورة وقلب الوطن بنغازي.
General Haftar insisted in a video message broadcast on Arab TV networks that military operations he was conducting were in response to a demand by the Libyan people to restore order and rid the country of terrorism. Libya's outgoing caretaker Prime Minister Abdullah Thani issued a statement read on Libyan TV accusing General Haftar's forces of trying to topple Libya's legitimate government. Forces loyal to General Haftar blocked roads around the parliament building as well as a road leading to the capital's main airport. Arab satellite channels also reported warplanes loyal to the general overflew the capital. His forces fought against Islamist militias in the eastern city of Benghazi on Friday. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Head of Syria's Air Defense Forces has been killed in clashes east of the capital, Damascus. Government officials said Syrian activists say that General Hussein Ishaq died in fighting with rebels at a Syrian air defense base. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights also reported Ishaq's death, saying he was killed in clashes with fighters from the Nusra Front, an al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and other Islamic rebel groups. Turkish authorities have charged three people, detained 22 others as part of an investigation into last week's deadly coal mine disaster in western Turkey that killed 301 miners. Dozens of prosecutors are investigating the cause of the explosion and the fire at a coal mine in the town of Soma. Nearly 800 miners were underground at the time of that blast. Many of those killed are believed to have died from carbon monoxide poisoning and suffocation. A preliminary report on the accident obtained by Turkey's Milliyet newspaper indicated several safety violations in the mine. Meantime, hundreds of people visited the main cemetery in Soma on Sunday to mourn the miners who lost their lives in the worst mining disaster in Turkish history. One local woman, Karidya Isaac, said the community was devastated that so many young people had died. And Arazia Encha said, our friends, neighbors died. We keep going to funerals. There is nothing we can do. We're sad. We're very sad, she said. The accident has triggered protests across Turkey aimed at government and at mine owners who say neglected safety. Mine operator Soma Kumur has denied any claim of negligence. Also in the news, United Nations warning that an alarming deterioration in human rights situation in Ukraine is threatening to tear the country apart. A report by the UN Human Rights Office documents unlawful activities of armed groups in the east and highlights emerging problems in Crimea since Russia annexed it in March. Johnny Magazzini is head of the European branch of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He says the apparent breakdown of law and order in eastern Ukraine is of great concern.
It points to evidence of lack of law and order and a number of very critical human rights violations and concern in the East, especially as a result of the presence, the action, the direct influence through the guns, but also indirectly through intimidation and threat on journalists, on ordinary people, when it comes to the ability for anyone to express oneself. Some self-proclaimed mayors have also banned some political parties.
The report finds differences between Russian law and Ukrainian law creating difficulties for Crimean residents. It notes that 7,200 people from Crimea, mainly Tatars, have left the peninsula and are displaced in other parts of Ukraine. Magazzini tells VOA the UN is very concerned about hate speech and other forms of harassment and intimidation being leveled at the Tatars. He noted Sunday was the 70th anniversary of the mass deportation of Tatars from Crimea by the government of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin.
We're very conscious of what they've gone through and the potential additional discrimination and the violations of their rights that may result from the issue of citizenship or statelessness. I think that is not an issue if they choose to leave, but what is the impact vis-a-vis their land, vis-a-vis their rights, vis-a-vis their work, vis-a-vis their family? For those who have stayed behind, those are critical issues that we would like to be able to monitor.
And weighing in on the issues, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Nave Pillay is urging all Ukrainian political leaders to stop inflaming the situation in the country and to allow the May 25th election to go ahead in a free and transparent manner. Meantime, billionaire businessman Petro Poroshenko has emerged as the leading candidate to win the first round of voting in Ukraine's presidential voting, which will be next Sunday. Pre-election polling shows the 48-year-old Poroshenko, known as the Chocolate King for his string of confectionery stores, far outpacing 18 other candidates, including former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. She was jailed for abuse of office by former President Viktor Yanukovych, but freed after he fled the country for Russia as Ukrainian took to the streets of Kiev to protest his government. Poroshenko has served as Ukraine's foreign minister and economic minister in previous administrations, including under the Moscow-based Yanukovych. But Poroshenko became the chief financier of the protest against Yanukovych and has vowed to repair the country's relationship with Russia. Meantime, emotions continue to run high in the Ukrainian port city of Odessa, 2 weeks after dozens of pro-Russian activists were killed in a fire that supporters blame on competing protesters from the pro-Europe movement. VOA's Al Pessin reporting now from Odessa.
On the plaza that was the scene of pitched battles on May 2nd, a priest led a small service on Sunday. Worshippers were few, but the service had particular meaning. This place has become a shrine for Odessans sympathetic to the pro-Russian activists. As they prayed, a crowd gathered, paying their respects at memorial displays and preparing for a protest. It all played out in front of the trade union's building, scarred from the inferno that engulfed it. Extensive destruction over several floors gives a hint of the horrors that unfolded. Pro-Russian demonstrators were inside and a hostile pro-European crowd outside. Exactly what happened is in dispute, but a fire broke out and spread quickly. Many people died on the spot and others jumped for their lives. Pro-Russian activists claim some of them were beaten to death, but the pro-European camp denies it. A few of the people who came out on Sunday were willing to talk to foreign reporters, their moods ranging between anger and sadness.
If we had a chance for reconciliation, it was before May 2nd. After that, the chances decreased significantly because talking to executioners makes no sense. We want peace, but we also want changes in our country. We are for Ukraine, but not the Ukraine imposed on us by Kiev.
No, no, I will never forgive this thing. Ukrainians tortured Ukrainians just because of different opinions, just because they wanted to stand up for their beliefs. I will die with this. I will never forgive. Sorry, I just cannot.
Odessans are Russian speakers, and many have family ties on the other side of the border. But this is southern Ukraine, not the east, where separatist sentiment runs high. People who would speak, even in this crowd heavy on ethnic Russian pride, said they want Odessa to remain part of Ukraine as long as local concerns are addressed. Al Pessin, VOA News, Odessa.
And a potentially seismic shift in the power dynamics of eastern Ukraine, industrial workers in Mariupol and other cities have risen up against armed separatists after business leaders claim that secession would be economically disastrous for the region. But many separatists believe that the oligarchs are also only looking at their own interest. Patrick Wells reporting now from Mariupol.
Smoke billows from Azovstal Steelworks in Mariupol, one of the many gargantuan industrial assets here owned by Ukraine's richest man, Rinat Akhmetov. Akhmetov employs more than 300,000 people region-wide, and this plant alone produces 4 to 5 million tons of steel per year for markets around the world. So far, during this uprising in Ukraine's two most heavily industrialized regions, the business community has kept quiet. But on an economic level, war is the ultimate recession. If the Donetsk People's Republic were to secede from Ukraine, it would only be recognized by a handful of countries, cutting off vital export markets in Europe and elsewhere. With this in mind, business leaders are now using their army of workers to exert a new influence on events here. They form patrols that have removed armed groups from checkpoints and occupied buildings around Mariupol. On Friday, the businessmen signed a memorandum with police, union leaders, and some separatists, renouncing political violence and calling for the disarmament of all armed groups. The directors of two steelworks owned by Akhmetov have been leading the patrols themselves. Yuri Zinchenko said it was important to take the views of the separatists into account, but not at such a cost.
All of us have good brains. We don't want to turn Donetsk into a war zone. All of us understand that this is just destruction. This is the road to nowhere.
There are now around 100 groups of men patrolling Mariupol, each consisting of 6 to 8 workers and 2 policemen. The workers recently forced separatists to abandon the Mariupol administration building, but as they patrolled there for the cameras on Friday, tensions were still high, and many in the watching crowd, like Alexander Sukovsky, felt betrayed.
Patrolling is a good thing, but you must understand, this is not a patrol. It is just a PR stunt from Comrade Akhmetov. Akhmetov is trying to show all of us that he is the real boss of the entire region.
Separatists who had met with the steel companies tried to win over the crowd, with mixed results.
The sense of this memorandum is to request the authorities in Kiev to pull their troops back from the borders of Mariupol and to dismantle the roadblocks.
Don't lie to people. Don't try to trick us.
The memorandum calls for the removal of armed forces on both sides from the city. But on Friday night, the Ukrainian military was still controlling access in and out. Patrick Wells, VOA News, Mariupol, Ukraine.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist, and she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
French President Francois Hollande says the Nigeria-based Boko Haram militant group has become a threat to all of West and Central Africa, and a comprehensive plan must be established to fight it. Mr. Hollande commented Saturday following a meeting with his counterparts from Nigeria and its neighboring countries. The meeting took place in the wake of the Islamist militant group's kidnapping of more than 300 Nigerian schoolgirls last month. Nigerian officials say 276 of the girls are still missing. While that meeting in Paris was taking place, Boko Haram attacked Wazza in Cameroon's far north region, kidnapping several Chinese engineers and killing one person, according to the local reporting. Moki Edwin Kinzida reports now from Yaoundé.
An estimated 200 Boko Haram members have attacked the Cameroonian locality of Wazza, located only 15 kilometers from Nigeria's Borno State, the base of the violent Islamist group. Cameroonian soldiers have been deployed to the area. The governor of Far North Cameroon, Fonka Awa Augustin, say it is very likely that some of the attackers are still on Cameroonian territory because the military was immediately deployed to the border with Nigeria.
There are quite a number of arrests that have been carried out. Investigations are on.
Fonka Awa added that they had asked for more troops from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
I want to let you know that the authorities in Yaoundé are all looking towards the far north region to ensure that things are stabilized and that Boko Haram, that is searching for a safe ground, does not find one.
Wazza is within Cameroon's Wazza National Park, a major tourist draw. The park is where a French family of seven was kidnapped last year. Earlier this month, Boko Haram attacked a military post some 60 kilometers from Wazza, freeing one of their group detained there and killing a Cameroonian soldier. They also left with ammunition. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Campaigning for Malawi's May 20th polls has ended with political parties holding their last rallies, 12 presidential candidates vying for the top post. And Lamek Messina reports now from Blantyre on the final campaign messages of the top four candidates.
The opposition My Congress Party wrapped up the campaign with a tour from Deza, one of its stronghold districts, to the capital, Lilongwe, where it held a rally at Masinta Ground. MCP President Lazarus Chakwera told his supporters it's sad Malawi is still poor 50 years after independence, and blamed that fact largely on the country's previous leaders. He says if politics means castigating opponents, self-enrichment, stealing from government coffers, then those who are saying that Chakwera doesn't know politics are absolutely right. He said if elected, Malawians will have improved welfare, and he pledged to make sure medicines are available in the country's hospitals. Like the MCP's Chakwera, the candidate from the United Democratic Front, Atubele Mulozi, had its last campaign rally in Lilongwe. He called for unity among Malawians and said the country will not prosper if it remains divided due to political differences. The presidential candidate for the Democratic Progressive Party, Peter Mutharika, finished his campaign at his home area, Goliati, in the southern district of Cholo. He promised a return to sound economic policies that he said the country had been known for before the death of the party's former leader, his brother, Bingwa Mutharika. Mutharika said if elected, his administration will reduce by half the prices of iron sheets and cement to ease the burden of building a house. President Joyce Banda of the ruling People's Party concluded her campaign in her home district of Zomba. President Banda took office after Bingwa Mutharika's death in 2012 and said she deserves a full mandate to continue what she has done. She says her administration is installing water tanks and tap water everywhere. She says they are also constructing 15 hospitals, and on education, they have constructed 10 secondary schools and are currently constructing 6 teacher training colleges, and above all, they are constructing houses for the rural poor. About 7.4 million Malawians are expected to vote for president, parliamentarians, and councillors. The elections are expected to be closely contested. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
So-called right to be forgotten is being debated after the European Court of Justice ruled that the internet search engine Google must sometimes, on request, remove links to articles containing personal information. As VOA's Kent Klein reports, it is a debate about in which more is what is more important, the right to privacy or the freedom of information.
Many people have something in their past that they would like to remove from the internet, says Glenn Gabe, president of G Squared Interactive, which provides digital marketing services to executives and celebrities. He spoke via Skype.
They went to prison, right? And maybe 10 years ago, everything happened, and everything's still showing up in Google on page one, even though that they paid their dues.
At the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Executive Director Mark Rotenberg agrees with the European Court that privacy is a basic right.
You have to consider the ability of individuals to control the dissemination of information about themselves. That is, in many respects, the core of free expression, how we choose to express ourselves or not to say things or do things. That's, you know, what makes us human.
A number of U.S. privacy advocates disagree with the European Court's Google ruling. It's likely to limit the freedom of information, says Jules Polonetsky, executive director of the Future of Privacy Forum.
So if someone can tell search engines or news aggregators or maybe bloggers, that information tells us about some individual, that individual doesn't want to be found, you need to take it down, the effects really could be dramatic. It breaks the internet.
The European Court ordered Google to delete links containing personal information about a Spanish lawyer's 1998 tax problems at his request because the information was no longer relevant. The right to a free press is specifically mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, while the right to privacy is merely implied. Jules Polonetsky says access to public information must be protected.
So it's a real blow to transparency if legal public information can be obscured simply because somebody decides that it's information they'd rather not be available.
But Mark Rotenberg says the European judges did a good job of balancing privacy with press freedom.
And what the European Court of Justice has done with this decision is to say, in effect, you know, search is an important service, but it has to be done in a way that protects privacy.
The ruling will be costly for Google and other search engines in Europe, but is not expected to immediately affect their U.S. operations. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
Swiss voters have overwhelmingly rejected a mandate for the world's highest minimum wage, nearly $25 an hour. Final results Sunday show by more than a 3-to-1 margin voters oppose what would have been the country's first minimum wage. Switzerland's ruling federal court welcomed the defeat of the minimum wage plan sought by trade unions. Government officials said it would have forced businesses to lay off workers. Brazilian organizers held the final two stadium tests for the World Cup on Sunday, including one at the troubled venue that will host the tournament opener in just a few weeks. Brazilian league matches were played to inaugurate a stadium in Sao Paulo and one in the western city of Cuiabá. Now all 12 World Cup stadiums have held test events ahead of football showcase tournament in June. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. We remind you that you can find us on the internet anytime at voanews.com. And I hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On May 19, 1643, representatives of four colonies, Massachusetts, New Haven, Plymouth, and Connecticut, met in Boston to sign the New England Confederation, primarily a military alliance to defend against attacks by Indian tribes. On this day in 1795, American financier and philanthropist Johns Hopkins was born. His legacy includes the world-famous Johns Hopkins University and Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. In 1864, American novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne died. He was known for his tales of colonial life in such classics as The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables. In 1890, Vietnamese nationalist leader Ho Chi Minh was born. He helped found the communist-dominated independence movement called the Viet Minh. Ho fought against Japanese occupation, French colonial rule, and later a U.S.-backed regime in South Vietnam. He died in 1969 before he could see his forces gain victory and unite Vietnam. In 1919, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, founder of modern Turkey, arrived in Samsun, Anatolia, an event seen as the start of the four-year Turkish War for Independence. In 1935, British officer Thomas Edward Lawrence, better known worldwide as Lawrence of Arabia, died following a motorcycle accident. Lawrence acted as liaison with the Arabs during several conflicts in the Middle East. His exploits gained him international fame. On May 19, 1994, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, wife of the assassinated President John F. Kennedy, later married to Greek shipping tycoon Aristotle Onassis, died of cancer. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Peace is within reach. U.S. co-chairman of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Minsk Group, James Warlick, said recently in Washington, D.C., in a statement of official U.S. government policy that guides the peacemaking process. The sides have come to a point where their positions on the way forward are not that far apart. For two decades, peace has been elusive in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. A generation of young people has grown up in Armenia and Azerbaijan with no firsthand experience of each other. Older generations do remember a time when Armenians and Azerbaijanis lived side by side and differences did not need to be resolved militarily. The key to any successful negotiation is for all parties to conclude that they have won something, Mr. Warlick said. In the case of the Armenians and Azerbaijanis, there is no question that a deal will unlock a new era of prosperity across the region. The benefits of peace far outweigh the costs of continued stalemate and avoid the catastrophic consequences of renewed hostilities. Armenia would immediately benefit from open borders, greater security, and new opportunities to trade, travel, and engage with all its neighbors, Mr. Warlick continued. Azerbaijan would eliminate a key impediment to its growth as a player on the world stage, regional trade hub, and a strong security partner, while giving hundreds of thousands of refugees and internally displaced persons a prospect for reconciliation and return. The thousands of people living in Nagorno-Karabakh would be freed from a prison of isolation and dependence. A peace agreement, properly designed and implemented, would also eliminate the tragic, steady stream of casualties, both military and civilian, along the border and the line of contact, he said. No less significant is the huge financial burden that military readiness and a growing arms race imposes on national budgets. A lasting peace must be built not on a piece of paper, but on the trust, confidence, and participation of the people of both Armenia and Azerbaijan, Mr. Warlick said in conclusion. Let's work together to build the demand for peace. Let's demand the benefits that a peaceful settlement will bring to people across the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.